not now asking whether these things are worldly or not, but rather insisting that men who do none of these things may be as worldly as men who do them all, and vice versa. Worldliness does not necessarily consist in these things. I repeat, therefore, there is necessity for great care as we approach this subject. Have any of you ever encountered those that are always bugged about being worldly? I've had about everything called worldly. I begin with the world in itself. Of course, you understand I'm speaking strictly within the limits of the use made of that word in the New Testament. The word has become almost part of our everyday speech. The word cosmos. Originally, it meant simply order. It was then used to describe the whole of the universe because of the universe's orderliness and its beauty. That's why cosmos referred to the world. So that the world itself does not at all suggest evil, it does not hint at disorder, but announces order. It has in it no suspicion of ugliness, but breathes the very spirit of beauty. That in itself is enough to make us pause and consider what is meant by the world and how the world became or becomes an opposing force. When a child speaks of the world, it thinks of the earth on which we live. And up to a certain point, quite accurately so thinks. May we not say that the word stands for the facts and forces of which man is conscious in his everyday life? That's not a perfect definition because there are multitudes of men and women who are conscious of facts and forces in everyday life which lie beyond the material. The world means the facts and forces of which material man is conscious, the facts and forces of which material man is a part, the facts and forces of which material man is or may be master. Things that can be seen and heard and smelled and tasted and handled, all that the senses can know is the world. These material things are also temporal, transient, passing. None of them abides. The form and the color change and fade and pass. Sound, though it be the most discordant or the most harmonious, ends. Fragrance passes away. Flavor dies. Nothing on which man has ever laid his hand is lasting. All the rocks are crumbling, temporal, transient, passing. The world, then, is the sum total of things material and temporal. I feel the utter inadequacy of the statement in certain ways. One might stay to speak of trees and plants and birds and beasts and men and cities. I leave all that to your imagination. All this is of God. The very material world in the midst of which we live is so marvelous that we are driven to the conclusion that it's easier to believe it to be the work of God than to believe that it originated any other way. I take up my Bible, go back to the story at its commencement, and amid all the poetry and marvel of that ancient story, I read this, quote, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. That is true until that hour. If you think of the world in its most material sense, if you think of the world in the simplest sense, there's nothing inherently evil in it. So how can it be part of this opposing force? Let me answer that inquiry by quotation of one passage written by Paul in his letter to the Romans. Quote, they worshipped the creature rather than the Creator. That is worldliness. It is when a man does that that the world is a... It is when a man does that, worshiping the creature rather than the Creator, that the world becomes an opposing force to religion. Let me put it another way. Worldliness consists in dealing with the material without recognizing the spiritual of which the material is an expression. Dealing with the things that are temporal without recognition of the things that are eternal. Living in the midst of the transient without having commerce with the abiding. When a man begins the religious life, he still feels the pull of the world. The temptation to deal with finite things, without placing upon them the measurement of the infinite, without weighing them in the balances of eternity. Let me illustrate even more practical. There may be worldliness in religion, in education, in commerce, and pleasure. I take these only as illustrative. The fact may doubtless be illustrated many other ways. There are two manifestations of worldliness and religion. Ritualism, rationalism. A man may be a ritualist, not be worldly. I've known men who, through form and ceremony and splendor of ritual, have commerce with God. But when a man observes so many days, so many ceremonies, and the observance being over, he turns back again to all the things that are contrary to the will of God. That's worldliness and religion. By rationalism, I mean contentment with present conditions. When religion deals simply with the present conditions of men and women, it's worldly in the extreme. A lot of preaching that only does that. Sometimes this type of religion charges those of us who believe in God and heaven and hell with being otherworldly, by which it makes unconscious confession that it is worldly, by accusing those of us that believe in God, heaven and hell as being otherworldly. They make a confession they are worldly. It is of the dust. It begins and ends there. Anything that attempts to deal with men simply on the level of this world, the betterment of human conditions, pure humanitarianism, possibilityism, is worldliness in religion. Hear me again. If a man have commerce with God and the eternities, he can't just concentrate on the things of time. Worldliness in religion begins and ends in things that are material. Come to God because of what He can do for you here and now. Sensual. Come get a spiritual fix in this meeting. Feel good now. And passing in both cases. Now, let me talk about how the world is an opposing force to religion. When it so engrosses my thoughts and attention, the things of time and the stuff of here and now, when it so engrosses my thought and attention, what I can have now and do now, and get and accomplish for me now, when it so engrosses my thought and attention as to make me unmindful of spiritual things and eternal things, when it so intrudes itself on my attention as to capture all my thinking and make me forget God, than the things of this world oppose religion. We have to face the fact that it's a very real force in opposition. I see the sights that dazzle, a song in Morgan's day. How often we have sung it and how awfully and appallingly true it is. Now let's stay here for a moment to notice the connection between the world, the flesh, and the devil. Because only by seeing the connection can we understand how it comes to pass that the world opposes religious life. It ought to be the most natural thing in all material things to discover the presence of the spiritual. It seems as though it was impossible for the man of Nazareth to touch anything of the earth, but that somehow it flamed with the glory of the heavens. Or to be more prosaic, he saw in it a lesson that pointed to eternity. Yet he was quite natural. We hardly like to use these words about him, yet you will understand me. A more artless and unaffected man never lived than Jesus of Nazareth. He loved the flowers, the gorgeous lilies of his own land. He looked at their beauty, and what did he say? Your father clothed them. And even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Children, how he loved them. Yes, but what did he see when he saw a child? The angel beholding the face of God. Except your faith become as one of them. And you be as these children. You can't be in the kingdom, trusting. Everything had a spiritual overtone. So you may pass through all his life and you will find a man with feet firmly planted on the earth, of the earth, belonging to it, and yet different from the earth, master of it, king of it. Whenever he touched it, he revealed by his touch its relationship to the boundless spaciousness of eternity in which forevermore he was at home. He stood on the plains of Judea and talked to men, and he used their own language. Their eyes looked at him, their hands handled him. There he was, and yet he spoke of himself as the Son in the bosom of the Father. That's utter, absolute opposite to worldliness. The world served the eternal meanings of which he was an expression. Now I ask this question, how comes it that the world which ought everywhere to reveal the heights, the world which ought to suggest God, makes me forget him? How? Get on the telephone and I'll continue after the station break. Okay, no more calls. How comes it that the world which ought everywhere to reveal the heights, the world which ought to suggest God, makes me forget him? Man's attitude in the presence of the world is determined by his own conception of himself. To live in the flesh is to be imprisoned by the material and temporal. Never to see through the garments of God in the green sward to the God who wears them, but to see only the grass. A self-centered and self-contained life seeks its satisfaction in, rather than through, the material world. What is a self-governed life? Come on, get in here with me. What is a self-governed life? It is a devil-governed life. A worldly, self-centered life always results from the dethronement of God. And the dethronement of God is always the result of listening to a lie from without. When you track back the forces that oppose religion, you find the devil behind them all. This world, all the fair and beautiful handiwork of God through which I ought always to find Him, hinders the essential spirit within me. Why? Because an enemy has come between my soul and God and persuaded me to dethrone him and enthrone self, and has blinded me so that I've lost the true perspective and proportion of things and the sense that discovers God everywhere. Is there victory over the world? I read my New Testament statement, quote, "This is the victory that hath overcome the world, even our faith." I go back to that passage and I find that the object of the faith that overcomes the world is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The soul bathing is begotten of God. The eye is opened. The ear is unstopped. The lost sense is restored. That's the final Christian evidence. You cannot make it known to any other man. That's what frustrates a preacher. You cannot make it known to any other man. It must be personal and immediate. No man need waste time trying to persuade me. There is no God, I know. No argument you can adduce in proof of the existence of God will convince me. No argument you can adduce against the existence of God will convince me. I know. As one man said in the presence of a material sign long ago, so say I in the presence of heaven and earth, on oath, one thing I know, whereas I was blind, now I see. Frustrates a preacher. I just have never been able to deliver myself from believing that because I see, if I can shine the light, others will see also. And I'm forever putting eyes on people that don't have them. Oh, how wonderful if you could see it. That God gave you sight to see His light. And the same light, painful, as I've come to know, will bring death to some. Oh, how I wish they would live. But they don't have the sight. How I wish the realization could come to those who have it. What a God-given treasure that sight is. Mark the issues of faith. Life becomes God-governed. That is the devil's defeat. As with Jacob last Sunday. self is found at last, while those without sight chase it and listen to Satan as an angel of light tell them they're chasing God. Life becomes God-governed. That is the devil's defeat. Self is found at last, realized within itself. Flesh is made subservient to spirit. Then, quote, all things are yours. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world. That's the promise to the Christian. Mark that well. I have not lost the world. I have found it. I have found it in that I've discovered that the material and the spiritual are related. That on every blade of grass shines the grace of God, and in all the prismatic colors of the rainbow is revealed His beauty. When did you last look at a rainbow and see through it to God's faithfulness? God's Word says He placed the rainbow there. It had never rained before the flood. They saw no rainbows before the flood. It had never rained. And He placed the rainbow there as a testament that never again would he destroy the world by flood. The rainbow's still there after every rain. And the centuries have rolled on. And there's never been another great flood to destroy the world. When did you last look at a rainbow and let it testify to your spirit, God keeps His Word, which is the basis of faith. I've found the world. Only the temporal is now seen in relation to the eternal. And change and decay are no longer destruction, but the perpetual process of that which abides. The man who has faith has not lost his world, but he's no longer worldly. What then is the final word of injunction in the presence of these opposing forces? And again, I quote from the New Testament and from Paul, quote, use the world as not abusing it, for the fashion of this world passeth away. That is to say, use the world, but never imagine that it is all, and never use it, save in its relationship to that larger whole of the spiritual and eternal. Deal with the things of dust, but touch them with the force of deity. Enter into all that the senses can reveal to you of the life in which you live. But know that for all these things God will bring you to judgment, not to punishment. That's to the world that knows not God. But we all, Paul said, shall appear before the judgment seat of Christ. To judgment, not to punishment. To judgment, the finding of a verdict and the passing of a sentence, the creating of a destiny. All the things of the world are mine, but I am not to live in them as though they were the whole. I am to understand that they are things of dust, and I am to treat them as such. To go back again to that word of John, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Dr. Chalmers' great sermon on that text is entitled, quote, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. What is the new affection? The true affection. Love of God. What does it do for a man? Puts out of his heart that love of the world which makes him forget God. and puts into his heart a new love of the world because he sees it to be the handiwork of his Father. I remember, as though it were yesterday, something that happened in my own life at least 37 years ago. I was a boy, and there came to my father's house a young man who had been brought to Christ in some meetings my father had been conducting in the Welsh Hills. This young man was out in our garden talking to me about all sorts of things. I remember how he interested me and how I loved him. Suddenly he stooped and picked up a leaf from a nasturtium plant. He held it in his hand and said to me, "Did you ever see anything so beautiful?" As a boy, I looked at it, saw all the veins and the exquisite beauty, and then he said this, and I never forgot it. I never saw how beautiful that leaf was until 6 months ago when he gave himself to Christ. How true I know that to be now in my own experience. The worldly man loses his world. The godly man finds it. Where are you going for your summer holidays? I strongly advise you to get right with God before you go, and if you will, you will have such a holiday as you never had. When a man crossing the ocean sits on deck and refuses to look at the sea because it's worldly, he's the most worldly man on board ship. He's self-centered, and even though he's spiritually proud, he's godless and worldly. The love of the Father, let that fill your heart, and then what? Then all the things he made are exquisite with beauty. You will listen to the music of the thunder at night and thank God that you are a child of the thunderer. You will look at all the wonders in creation and rejoice more than ever that you are the heir of God who made them and that consequently they belong to you. I have lost neither poetry nor art nor music because I am his in answer to the call of his grace. I have found them because I no longer believe that they are all. When you look on a painting and tell me it will fade, I tell you not half so soon as the pictures he paints. He is so great an artist that he flings a picture on the sky and as you look it is gone, but in 10 minutes there's another. All the things of beauty in the world are mine because I am his and he is mine. When you lose your vision of God, you lose your sense of the eternal and live wholly in the things of his beautiful world. Then you have imprisoned your own soul. May God deliver us from all worldliness by bringing us into such unity with himself that we shall look nowhere without seeing him, touch nothing without feeling him, be in the midst of no circumstances without being conscious of him. Go on telephone.